Today is going to be a little bit different. We've been going through this study on government. And last week, we talked about what godly government looks like. Praise of those who do good, punishment of those who do evil. Pretty simple. God explains it. I just want to read Romans 13 again before we get into what we're going to be talking about today. It says, every person is to be in, verse 1, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. And then toward the end, he says in verse 7, render to what is due, tax to whom tax, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And then again, if we go back to 1 Peter chapter 2, I'll just read it for you real quick. Verse 13, submit yourselves to the Lord's sake for every human institution, whether to king as one in authority or to governors as sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. So then verse 17, he says, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So the topic we're going to be discussing over the next couple of weeks is America. Specifically, two things. Today, were the colonists justified in the rebellion against England? Because if you're supposed to submit to the kings and the governors as sent by him, were the colonists justified in the rebellion against England? Number one. Number two, next week, you know, we're going to be discussing the concept of the very sticky situation the American Christian is in. Because essentially, little sneak peek, essentially, we have two competing laws in our society. And based upon a person's conscience, it's going to determine where they end up on this. Many of the laws today that exist are in direct violation of the Constitution. So where does the American Christian fall? Do they follow the Constitution or do they follow the laws as written today? So we'll discuss that next week. And there's not really a cut or dry answer to that. That's why in the previous weeks, we discussed the concept of principle, execution of principle, and then conscience and liberty, where people have the freedom to have differing views and pursue differing courses of action. Today is an American history lesson. Aren't you excited? Where we will be discussing, were the colonists justified? Because I know I've had this question. I know some of y'all have had this question. And I've been asked this question and heard people discuss it in the past. So I did a lot of research on this, and I will tell you this. All of my information came from the internet, as it mainly does today. So I will say this. There are some of you who probably know, and here and listening, who probably know this history much better than I do. So I would ask for your grace if I make a mistake, but I think the overall theme is correct from what I've studied and put together. So the first thing I wanted to discuss is what was the system of government in the colonies and how did they coexist with England? This is really important in determining what's about to take place. So the self-government in the colonies took many different forms, and I've got tons of notes here, so we're going to be running all over the place today. First off, you had colonial assemblies. Now, this should ring a bell for us because we live in Virginia, and Virginia was one of these. So each colony had its own legislative body known as the colonial assembly or colonial legislature. And members of this assembly were elected by eligible voters within the colony. So right there, you can see right from the get-go, when they were established in the 1600s, they had a lot of self-government. that needed to take place and was taking place. The colonial assembly had the authority to pass laws, levy taxes, and manage local affairs. One of the prime examples is the Virginia House of Burgesses, which, by the way, was dissolved when Patrick Henry told King George to pay attention about Caesar and Brutus, and then Charles and Cromwell, because Cromwell killed Charles, Brutus killed Caesar, and he said George would do well to pay attention to those. To which the response in the crowd was treason, and Patrick Henry gave his famous line, not give me liberty or give me death, but if this is treason, then let's make the most of it. Right after that, Dunmore, Lord Dunmore, I believe, dissolved the House of Burgesses, to which the delegates in Virginia promptly restarted it and met in Richmond at St. John's. And that's where Patrick Henry gave his famous speech, right down the street. So Virginia House of Burgesses was established in 1619, one of the earliest colonial assemblies, played a crucial role in self-government and served as a model for other colonies. So the other thing you had after colonial assemblies, you had charter colonies. Colonies such as Connecticut and Rhode Island operated under royal charters that granted them significant authority. So the concept that I want you to see here is that the original charters came from the crown, from Parliament, and these legislatures were given tremendous amounts of self-governing authority in the original agreements. That is very important for what we're discussing. These charters provided for the establishment of representative governments with elected assemblies and governors appointed by the colonists themselves. An example, the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut, founded in 1639, is often regarded as the first written constitution in America. In an established representative government with an elected legislature with high degrees of self-government. Then you had proprietary colonies. Pennsylvania was one of them. William Penn was the proprietor that the crown gave Pennsylvania to. And what he did in 1681, they had a relatively liberal government with an elected assembly and a governor appointed by Penn. So they themselves had a lot of autonomy. And then one of the other ones that they had was something called town meetings. This is specifically used in New England. As a matter of fact, I looked up the town that I grew up in, Minot, Maine, and they had their town meeting about a year ago where they, in the town meeting, elected their school board. So these town meetings are held all over New England, and that's how they do their elections. Then you also had county governments. Virginia was a big one of this. They established county governments in the 1600s with elected officials such as sheriffs and justice of the peace. And they were responsible for maintaining law and order, overseeing courts, and managing public services like roads and bridges. Now, why is this important? It's important for us to understand that the colonies were established as having a high degree of self-governance and autonomy. That was the original agreement. Now, where a lot of this was a reaction to, if you go back and study, one of the concepts that you'll see is a concept called the divine right of kings. The divine right of kings was a concept that stated that kings believed that they were appointed by God, using the passages that we're using, that they were appointed by God and had absolute authority and were accountable to no one but God. So you can see how a king would take the passages that we just read and twist that to think that they were completely unaccountable by anybody. Now, in England, there was a movement away from the divine right of kings that culminated in 1688 in an event called the Glorious Revolution. It was a bloodless coup where James II was deposed. He was a Catholic king. He was deposed in favor of Protestant king. And in 1689, there was something called the English Bill of Rights that was passed. You should read that sometime. And you would think that the colonists, had a hand in writing that. Because there were a lot of grievances that the people had against the king. Taxation without representation, the arbitrary nature of how the king operated, keeping a standing army during peacetime, all of these different types of things. And Parliament established this English Bill of Rights. But here's the problem. They did not extend it to the colonies. Even though they were English subjects, they were not protected by the English Bill of Rights, which means that the way that Parliament did things was very arbitrary. And that's what we're going to discuss, is the arbitrary nature. In other words, there was no rule of law, essentially, that governed Parliament's treatment of the colonies. They didn't feel the need to abide by the original agreements, because when a king died, it's like, okay, Parliament can do what they want and change things. So the reaction to the divine right of kings, the way that I kind of understand it, and again, I could be wrong on this, that concept of being unaccountable really moved over to Parliament, and Parliament had the ability to do whatever it is that they wanted. And they used to think, well, hey, you know, there's checks and balances. We're elected. But the people who could vote in the elections was very limited in England, exceedingly limited. So the rank and file individual that lived in the country didn't have a say in who was elected because they couldn't even vote. It was only the landowners of a specific size. I couldn't find the specific size, but it was large landowners were the only ones that were allowed to vote. So let's take a look at some of these laws here. And I'm going to go in chronological order, because what I want you to see is that during the 1600s, there were several acts that were passed, but they weren't overbearing. It wasn't until we get to after the French and Indian War that things get really, really nasty in the American colonies. There was a series of acts called the Navigation Acts from the 1660s up to about 1673, might be a few later than that. But it was a series of laws aimed at regulating colonial trade and ensuring British economic dominance. So basically, it stated that colonial goods could only be transported on English ships. So, you know, the American colonies were all interested in trading and working with other nations, not just being dependent upon Britain. They wanted to be able to trade with other colonies because it was good for the colonies. British said, nope, you can only transport on British ships. So if Britain was at war with somebody, obviously you can't trade with those folks. In 1663, it required all European-bound goods for America to first be shipped to England and then re-exported. So you can imagine that that caused the price of goods to go up and limited trade as well. And then there were duties on certain colonial exports, further restricting the trade among the colonies. So taxes on their exports. So it made their goods more expensive to other places. Then one of the things that happened, and this was interesting. So you had the original colonies that made up New England, along with New York and New Jersey, brought under this creation called the Dominion of New England. And this took place 1686 to 1689. And James II did it. It's one of the reasons why he was deposed. What he did is he took all the colonial charters and he suspended them. So all of the original agreements that these colonies had, he suspended them and brought them under a singular governor, a royal governor, that trampled on the rights of the people and violated the original agreements that they had set. Now, again, this sparked a lot of resistance. It sparked the Siege of Boston. All kinds of stuff took place in 1689 that was along with this, or 1688, somewhere there. But it resulted in the overthrow of James II and the end of this thing called the Dominion. That ushered in, at the end of the late 1600s, it entered in or created a period that was called the Period of Salutary Neglect. Now, when you think of neglect, you think of that something bad. Well, the word salutary means that it was beneficial. It was healthful for the colonies. So Britain was otherwise occupied. In this period of salutary neglect, they were occupied with all kinds of domestic things. During this period of salutary neglect, which lasted from the end of the 1600s to 1763, Basically, they left the colonies alone. They let them do their thing. They didn't enforce a lot of the Navigation Acts, and the colonies were allowed to trade, and they were allowed to become prosperous. You know, it was lax enforcement of colonial regulations and allowing the colonies a degree of self-governance and economic freedom. Here's what it allowed the colonies to do. Reestablish their self-governance, their autonomy, their legislatures, the making of laws, their own government. And each one of these colonies was completely independent to do these things. They were still subject to the British Crown, but the British Crown was leaving them alone. Okay? So it allowed the colonies to develop their own economies, institutions, cultures, with minimal interference from Britain. Fostering representative assemblies, trade, and industry contributed to colonial prosperity and self-reliance, which included the ability to defend themselves, which they needed. So the French and Indian War lasted from 1754 to 1763. Now remember, when did America declare independence? 1776. So this is leading right up to that. From what I can tell, and this might not be a complete list, from the period of 1763 to 1776, there were no less than 11 or 12 acts that were perpetrated against the colony when there might have been that many during the entire period of salutary neglect, maybe less. So what precipitated Britain saying, we're done leaving you alone, and now we're going to put you under our thumb? Well, they got into a lot of debt. A lot of debt from the French and Indian War. And they saw this cash cow called the colonies of America. And so they decided to do a whole bunch of things. Well, one of the things that they did was in 1763, after the French and Indian War, they prohibited any expansion west of the Appalachians. So there was no ability for the colonists to expand. There were stricter enforcement of trade regulations and tax collection by the British authorities that undermined colonial autonomy and contributed to growing tensions. Some of the acts that were there, one was called the Sugar Act. So it placed duties and taxes on imported sugar and other goods. And then you had the Stamp Act. Now, this one actually caused a lot of problems, and it ended up never going into effect from what I understood. But it imposed a direct tax on various printed materials in the colonies, including newspapers, legal documents, playing cards, without colonial representation in Parliament. And this was the big issue. Taxation without representation. They weren't covered by the Bill of Rights. They had no representation. And here's what England said in response when the colonists would bring this up. They said, you guys are virtually represented. And the colonists said, that's not a thing. That doesn't exist. There's no such thing as virtual representation. You were either represented or not. And they weren't. They couldn't vote. They had no representation in England for their affairs. And England just viewed them as something to tax and to oppress. Okay, so, and one of the things that the Stamp Act was trying to accomplish, again, this is somebody's interpretation of it, but it makes sense from when I read the act and what it entailed. A couple different things. It really curtailed specifically pamphlets. And if you pay attention to the pre-revolution time frame, pamphlets were a big deal in getting the messages out. And then another thing was, if you were an attorney and you needed a license, they completely hamstrung your ability to get it by charging a tax that in today's dollars was $2,500 just to get an attorney's license. And they put this tax on all kinds of things, land and all kinds of things like that. So it really presented a huge burden for people to be able to conduct business and live life here. But again, it didn't actually go into effect because there was a big protest against it. In 1776, there was something called the Townshend Acts, which imposed duty on imported goods like tea, glass, paper, leading to boycotts and protests in the colonies. There was the Tea Act in 1773, which gave the British East India Company a monopoly on tea sales in the colonies, which completely undercut colonial merchants and was going to put people out of business, and that sparked the Boston Tea Party. Then there were a couple of other acts that denied colonial rights. 1765, the Quartering Act. Now remember what the British Bill of Rights said, keeping a standing army in time of peace, no go. But in the colonies, that was allowed. So they were violating their own law in the colonies. So it required colonial assemblies to house and feed British troops, violating their rights and creating tension. So these are just a handful of them. There were actually several more. So this period of salutary neglect ended because Britain was tremendously in debt. Just a little side note. When you have a country that's tremendously in debt, the freedom of the people gets trampled. I don't know how in debt Britain was, but I don't think it was $34 trillion. When you look at the tax burden that we face as Americans, it's absolutely offensive and oppressive to pay the taxes that we pay. Now, I know what the Bible says, and we should pay them. But this we'll get into a little bit more next week. We also have the ability to try to change some things. And I know we're a small group of people, but I also know that I don't know if a majority of Americans believe they're paying too much taxes, but I would bet a lot of them do. And if those people would just wake up and work within the system of the checks and balances that we have to create these things, I think things could change. But it also depends on if this is the will of God or if the way America's going is also going to accomplish this. Well, we don't know. Our job, though, is simply to do what we're supposed to do. Bottom line is we do what we're supposed to do and don't really care about the consequences. That's what Christians are all about. We're just supposed to do what we're supposed to do. If it's successful, great. If it's not successful, we still did what we were supposed to do. Right, and again, we'll talk a little bit more about that next week. One of the other aspects of, and I want to spend a little bit of time on this. One of the other aspects that was really at play here was Enlightenment philosophy, specifically a guy by the name of John Locke. So remember we talked a little bit about the divine right of kings. Kings able to do whatever they wanted to do in Parliament really kind of snuck in under that, and they were just going to implement their will against the colonies no matter what. John Locke and others before him started to grab a hold of this concept called the consent of the governed. And if that sounds familiar, it's in our Declaration of Independence. I would go back and read that if I were you. If you haven't read it for a while, it's a great read. And it talks about how government derives their authority by the consent or from the consent of the governed. In other words, government, the way our founding documents are established, it establishes the concept that our government only exists by our consent. If that sounds like a revolutionary type of concept, it's because it is. When they wrote that, they were declaring independence and starting a revolution. Well, the revolution had already started before that. They were just acknowledging that. There were several battles, Lexington and Concord, Bunker Hill, all that stuff took place before 1776. But John Locke emphasized the natural rights of individuals, including life, liberty, and property, and the idea that government legitimately derives from the consent of the governed. Locke's philosophy influenced colonial resistance to British rule as colonists increasingly invoked natural rights. So remember what they said about nature's law or natural law and nature's God in the Declaration of Independence? So they recognize they just didn't appeal to natural law. They appeal to the God who created that natural law as the reason for what they were doing. And when you list, when you see all the things that they list that were the grievances that they had against the crown, specifically Parliament, though, because Parliament was the one that was in control of all that. George III, he was just primarily a figurehead in a lot of ways, because Parliament was the one that passed all these taxes and did all of these things. What they were telling him was that you're even violating the laws that you state in your country you're supposed to abide by. You're telling us that we're subjects, but we're not privy to the rights of your subjects. You're able to just come in and do whatever you want, whenever you want, violating the previous agreements that we had. And so here's where I've come down on when it comes to what were the colonists justified in what they did. The original charters allowed them to establish self-government, autonomy, legislatures. Who was it that declared independence? It was the Continental Congress and the people that were delegates of that Congress. It was the government of the colonies that the people of... So basically, you had two governments that the people of this land of the original colonies were subject to. You had the crown, and you had the local autonomous governments. The local autonomous governments banded together and declared independence. So you, as an individual, if you lived at that time as an individual Christian, you would have a choice that you would have to make. Would you submit to the crown and their trampling of your rights, invoking the name of God, but denying the name of God constantly? Or would you submit yourself to the government of the land in which you lived and the Declaration of Independence that they just made? With Romans 13, 1 Peter chapter 2, and Colossians chapter 3, you could, in very good conscience, submit to the government of the United States in the rebellion against the crown. Because what they were doing was the government of this land was establishing their independence, because the government that they that stated they had authority over them was consistently violating their own laws and agreements that they had established at the very beginning, at the foundation. And that's why they stated that it was their duty to do this. So, like I said, I know a lot of people, and again, short message today, I know a lot of people have had questions about this. You know, was the American Revolution justified? You know, when you're supposed to submit to government? America has always been and continues to be a very complex situation. So were the colonists justified? Absolutely. Absolutely. Was Romans 13 followed by an individual if they decided to follow the exhortation of join or die and they decided to join? Yes. They could be in complete subjection to Romans 13, 1 Peter chapter 2, in following the American cause. Without a doubt. But on the flip side, a person following the crown could have been justified too, in my opinion. Because they could have made the argument that this was the sovereign above the local government. So what I'm saying is it wasn't necessarily cut and dry. It would have been a tough time to live. Because you had a lot of people that viewed themselves as loyal subjects to the crown. And in the Olive Branch Petition that was given in 1775, this was after Bunker Hill, the Olive Branch Petition in 1775, basically what that stated was what that stated. They kept calling themselves the loyal subjects of the crown, even though they had been in a couple of armed conflicts already. And they were trying to redress their grievances with the king, and the king wouldn't even read it. And in fact, what the king did at that particular point is on August 23rd, 1775, he passed an act called, and the parliament passed it, the Proclamation of Rebellion and Sedition, that declared the colonies an open rebellion that needed to be crushed in any way, shape, or form. Simply by them trying to regress or redress their grievances. So pay attention to that, that the crown viewed them in rebellion and sedition and was going to crush the rebellion before the colonies declared independence and still viewed themselves as loyal subject to the crown. So, as a result of that, July 4, 1776, that's what took place. So, be open for questions. And again, like I said, please forgive me if I got any of my facts wrong. I apologize. You know, internet's a squirrely place. But hopefully the flow and I'm sure there's other things that factored into that. I was just trying to find some specific themes that related to Romans 13 and follow that thread through to see if there was justification. So, if anybody has any corrections or comments, you know, feel free to catch up with me afterwards, but let's go ahead and close out with a word of prayer.